Coming up today, the UK's oldest robot lurches back to life. We find out what Oculus Rift founder Palmer Luckey did on the week of his 24th birthday. And I get the Wired podcast team to make their pitch for the next big on-demand economy startup. Uber, beware. You're listening to episode 286 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
And Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
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 We have a bit of a running joke that Roland always says, hello, exactly the same.
Hello.
Hello. Matt Burgess, what did you learn this week?
This week I learned that it is World Rhinoceros Day today, and because of that, I decided to go and look at the meaning of the word rhinoceros. And it comes from two Greek words, rhino, meaning nose, and soros, meaning horn. So, nose horn.
Nose horn. Makes sense. Yep. Amelia, what did you learn this week?
I learned that the Northumbria University wants to pay volunteers to drink red wine for a study, which I think is a pretty good idea.
Why?
So, the team are looking at resveratrol, which is found in red wine, and is supposed to boost mental function by increasing blood flow to the brain. So if you're healthy and between 50 and 70, you can get paid £30 to test red wine and do some brain activities.
Sounds like something that any sane human being should be involved in. Roland, I'll get to you in a minute. So I learned this week that in 2001, 5% of Lego boxes sold contained a Lego weapon. I want you guys to guess what that number was in 2014. So it was 5% of Lego boxes contained a Lego weapon in 2001.
52%.
52%.
65%.
65, like the majority. Okay, yeah.
I'm going to go counterintuitively and say 4%.
Oh, so you think it went down?
No, but I just thought that might be a clever guess.
No, it was 30%. I'm kind of surprised by that. I just think that Lego's quite a tame toy.
Has it got anything to do with Star Wars?
Ah, that could be it. Or things like Indiana Jones.
A lot more movie tie-ins.
Yep, that could be it. So maybe it's slightly less sinister. Roland, what did you learn this week?
I don't know why you're saying it like that.
Yours is less of a fact and more of a pitch, but go on.
Well, so something that I didn't really learn this week, and in fact that I've known about for the last 6 months, is the Wired Audi Innovation Awards. This is some awards that we're running for the first time this year to find the best British innovators in a variety of categories.
Okay, and the Moonshot category, which people can actually vote in until the end of September, that's a really exciting opportunity for people to decide who they think is sort of the biggest innovator of the year, in a way.
Well, sort of. So a Moonshot, for those of you who don't know, is an attempt to do something kind of almost completely impossible. So the famous Moonshot, the one where the term comes from, is when President Kennedy said, we should go to the moon. And no one really had a clue how they were going to do it, but they managed it within 5 years. And so we got a bunch of very impressive people to nominate a series of British moonshots. And yes, you can vote for them on the Wired website.
So who have we got?
So we've got Target for Malaria. They're trying to reduce the number of malaria mosquitoes in Africa. We've got Reaction Engines. They're developing hardware to take man to Mach 5, which is very fast. We've got DeepMind. They're the company who...
They've done all right.
Yeah, they've done a bunch of things already. Their moonshot is trying to make artificial general intelligence, which is basically machines that can think like humans. We've got Novasang making billions of red blood cells in a lab in Glasgow. Hybrid air vehicles, basically making great big balloons that you can float in or occasionally crash land in.
Slowly.
Well, yeah.
Yep.
That happened recently when they just tried their launch. But the thing about moonshots is that they're extremely hard and they don't necessarily need to succeed to teach you something about what's possible, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So is that it? There's more?
There's more. There's
Go
more.
On.
Shall I carry on?
Go on.
Okay.
Quickly.
Okay. There's the 100,000 Genome Project, there's Open Bionics, and What Three Words. You can find out more about all of them on the Wired website and vote for your favourite.
Wired.co.uk to cast your vote. Our first story this week is about the UK's oldest robot, who's called Eric. Matt Burgess, you went to visit Eric under a railway arch in Brixton.
I did. So I didn't actually visit Eric, as I'm going to explain. This one was a recreation of the original robot, which was built in 1928, which was Britain's first robot. And basically, he was lost and now he's being rebuilt.
So why? Why would they want to do this?
So basically, Eric was one of the first robots in the, well, he was the first robot in this country and one of the first sort of robots that actually looks like a robot as we know it. So he was a big sort of 6 foot tall aluminium man that looks like your typical sort of idea of a robot.
What's the name? What's the name of the, yeah, like the Tin Man or the, what are the baddies in Doctor Who called? The Cybermen?
The Cybermen, yeah. He looks a little bit like a Cyberman, but is nowhere near as sinister and definitely doesn't have any sort of lasers and can beam people and destroy people. But yeah, so this original robot was built in the 1920s. He was built basically to appear at a engineering festival and open this engineering festival after another dignitary pulled out. And when he was built, he could basically stand up. He could talk a bit, he could move around, he could move his arms a little bit, raise up and down, and just basically was a creation that nobody had really seen before.
And it caused a bit of a stir at the time, and there's some great quotes from reports at the time that they said that he caused amazement with his enormous size, and while the stark immobility of his face gave him a really terrifying quality, and he is a little bit eerie. He might not be a Cyberman, but he's still kind of weird looking.
Yeah, and I think just at the time, it was just something that people hadn't really seen in the 1930s. Technology was only just starting to happen here. But he wasn't a robot in the same sort of sense that we would imagine robots today. So inside him was a lot of pulleys and gears and ropes and things, just basically to move him around, because they didn't have the same sort of electronics that we've got now to be able to create intricate movements, fine details. But also, we don't really know what was inside him as well, because some of the pulleys and details and stuff that I've just mentioned, they were sort of hinted by the creators, but they never really said how he was working.
Okay, and he was lost almost by accident, which kind of created this mystery around him.
Yeah, because he was such a strange thing for people to see and a bit of a showman's piece, he actually went around the world on a tour. He went around Europe, he went around the US, he went to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a really big, obviously, technological university in the US, and he basically didn't come back or wasn't really found. So I spoke to the curator, Ben Russell, who is at the Science Museum, who is actually running this project and actually rebuilding Eric. And he said that Eric probably got cannibalized. And to quote him directly, he suspected what happened to Eric was that they started to build George, his successor. They basically took all the useful stuff out of him and cast what was left to one side as scrap. And then George got hit by a bomb in the Second World War.
As you do. So quite a tragic end for the project, but it was rebooted on Kickstarter, raised the amount of money it needed, and the Science Museum has now gone about putting it back together. What's the point, though?
The point is really to show robotic history. So Eric is going to be part of an exhibition next year in February at the Science Museum, in a big robotics exhibition showing robots from basically the 1500s to now. And they're not quite robots as we would think of them necessarily. They are just mechanical men. So obviously before the 1920s, there was even less technology, and the robots from the 1500s, basically ancient Chinese robots, are just really mechanical in terms of engineering and gears rather than electronics.
Yeah. Well, it sounds really amazing. So you can head down to the Science Museum to check that out. Roland, you're hovering with intent.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Matt a question. So in your piece, which I really enjoyed, you said that Eric was able to crack jokes. How did you manage that?
So this was the original Eric. He was actually, they believed to have some sort of radio technology into his system. And because we don't really know how he did work, and there was no drawings or blueprints, so when they were rebuilding the new version of Eric, they had to go off just the pictures of the outside of him, so inside he's now completely modern. But I think, and the creators and the builders have remade this and researched it into a hell of a lot of detail, actually say that, yeah, there was probably some electronics and radio mics that were going to him to make him talk at the time, and apparently he used to crack jokes and sort of, they changed what he said, so it was probably some sort of radio mechanism that
some
was
sort
activated,
of transmitter system.
Yeah, activated by a button, I think, as well, that probably did this, but we don't really know.
Which in 1928 must have been bleeding terrifying. You have this sort of creaking, walking, talking Cyberman.
He would have been just really astounding. And the reports from the time, from sort of the New York Times, just basically said people were slightly in fear and in slightly in awe and just didn't really believe how this worked. And I think that was part of why they never really revealed what was inside him, just to keep that mystery. And obviously it was a bit of a commercial product at the time, so when it was touring around the world, people didn't really want to show off what was inside Eric, because if they did, somebody else would go and copy him, and then he would just be rebuilt by others. So,
which caused the problem 90 years later when they came to rebuild him. So check it out at the Science Museum Robots exhibition. Really, really cool project, and read more about it on Wired UK. Elsewhere this week, Oculus Rift has launched in the UK. So this is the first mass market virtual reality headset. The HTC Vive is also around PlayStation, Sony. What do they call their VR project? PlayStation VR.
Yeah, they used to call it Project Morpheus, but they changed the name.
Yep, wisely. So VR is now a thing. We've talked about it an awful lot on the podcast. But Roland, this week, you spoke to Palmer Luckey, who is the guy who created Oculus Rift.
Yes, exactly. So Oculus was the first mass market headset, or the one that really made us think that VR could be once again possible. And it all started when Palmer Luckey, at the time he was 19, he put a listing on Kickstarter for a headset that could actually do VR. And lots of other ones have come out since, but this is the first one, and now it's on sale in the UK. So I had a chat with Palmer, and he was a really interesting guy. I mean,
was the day after his 24th birthday.
Yeah.
So he invented Oculus when he was 19. I think, what was I doing when I was 19? Probably drinking too much vodka. What was he doing? Inventing potentially a really transformative piece of technology that, well, you can't shut up about.
Yes, exactly. And then, of course, a couple of years after he put that listing on Kickstarter, his company got bought by Facebook for $2 billion. So now he's worth, according to Forbes, $700 million.
Okay. So the money's interesting, maybe, yep, depending on your viewpoint. But what's interesting about the man, about this human being that's done something quite unusual for a 24-year-old?
Well, so what was interesting to me was the fact that he didn't really, and obviously, I mean, this is just my impression, he didn't really seem to have changed that much. I said, how much has changed? He said, to be honest, I'm just doing the same thing I always were, playing with VR, playing with hardware, messing around, trying to make this cool thing that I want to see.
You might think, as a multi-millionaire, that you'd have very wild birthday parties and like lots of lavish celebrations, but no. No?
No, he said, I said, what did you do on your birthday? Palmer said, I worked.
As you do.
And then I was like, oh, okay, that's a little bit disappointing. He's like, no, that was really great. I mean, all my friends are at Oculus anyway, so it was fun.
He went out for a quiet meal, I think he said, but he had lots of work to do.
Exactly. And I spoke to him the next day at 9 a.m. San Francisco time, and he was up bright and breezy, fresher than me, really. So, all in all, he was an incredibly impressive, articulate, friendly human face of virtual reality, and it was a real pleasure to talk to him.
Which is interesting, because quite often the interesting people in companies are hidden behind these sort of walls of PR and marketing and glitz, and you never really get that one-to-one interaction with them, and when you do, they can often stick to a script that they've been given and trained on. But he was
very open,
free and easy.
Yes, and I think there was to paint a picture of Palmer Luckey, He was homeschooled, and he always kind of fiddled with bits of kit. And this was how he ended up making the virtual reality headset. He dropped out of college, but he didn't drop out of Stanford or Harvard. He dropped out of journalism school, so he really was on a path to nowhere. He wears Hawaiian shirts and flip flops, or walks around barefoot, because he doesn't really like wearing shoes. And when instead of becoming the CEO and the leader of Oculus, he didn't want to do that. And instead, he has a sort of a kind of hard to define role. He kind of helps people out, and I think in some way he's kind of, his role is to be the soul of the company, to think about the things that virtual reality should be and what makes it exciting.
And I think one thing that I really got from your piece and talking to him was that he isn't just about Oculus. He does really look at other pieces of virtual reality and really praise them a bit publicly as well.
Yeah, exactly. And because I mean, people, you know, startup founders will always say things like, oh, hey, you know, we don't want to win. We just want the technology to come to fruition.
Lies.
Well, maybe. Yes. Well, often it didn't seem that sincere. But with him, it seemed totally sincere. And in fact, you know, looking at his Twitter feed, you can see that he often tweets out things about other companies. you really get the impression that he just wants to see virtual reality happen. And in some way, he doesn't really care how it happens, whether it's Oculus or not.
He's not really a businessman in that respect.
Yes, exactly. And in a way, I this was the one question I kind of that I came away from the interview wondering. I mean, you know, this virtual reality stuff, it could get really pretty serious. I mean, you know, if you think of the relationships, for example, between Apple, Google and Facebook, they're not that friendly. And I wonder what Palmer Luckey will be doing on his birthday next year and maybe in 5 years' time, if he can stay this happy-go-lucky character.
Will he still be happy to have a phone call at 9 a.m. local time the day after his birthday? Or will he have more pressing things on his mind?
Who knows?
So this is a question that we love to ask at Wired. Where does he see virtual reality going next? What's next?
So I guess in the near future, he kind of names a few technologies that that we might see. So he thinks the virtual reality headsets will be lighter, they'll be higher resolution, they'll be more portable, all that sort of stuff. He also talks about other things like eye tracking and facial recognition. This is basically so you can get a realer impression inside virtual reality. But I think what I found that was so interesting is the way he talked about the far, far vision of VR. So this one quote really stood out to me. He said, "It is potentially the final computing platform." This is generalizing, but if you have perfect virtual reality, you don't have to perfect much else. As in, this is it. Once we can do everything we want, be anywhere we want, have supernatural powers in computing, we've done it. That's it. Computer age over.
We've done this before on the podcast, and he said all of that while most people are still eating their cornflakes and picking the sleep dust out of their eyes. So, impressive guy. It's a really, really interesting interview. It is. It's more focused of him as a personality and kind of what it's like to have a conversation with him, which doesn't happen that often. Not a lot of people speak to him. So it was a really cool thing that Roland was able to do. Our third story this week, I have dubbed the Zucker Splurge. Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan are going to use a lot of their money to cure and prevent and manage all diseases by the year 2100, as you do. So Palmer Luckey, I mean, go on, step aside. This is hugely ambitious stuff. So Zuckerberg and his wife have invested $3 billion, that's about £2.3 billion, of their personal wealth into organizations and companies conducting medical research, and they're going to be investing that over the next 10 years gradually as they go along. So apparently this is 99% of the money that they've earned through the operation of Facebook, and this is basically going to be something that they'll run for their entire lives. That a huge philanthropic gesture on sort of a Bill and Melinda Gates level to tackle what they see as a really, really important problem. It was something that they announced last year in a somewhat strange way. They addressed it in a letter to their newly born daughter, and they said that they wanted her to grow up in a world where these things had been solved, or that they were working towards solving these things. Mark Zuckerberg has a hell of a lot of cash, and now they've actually given some detail as to what they're going to do with it. So I wonder, does anyone want to take us through this? Amelia?
Yeah, I'll go. Right, so they've decided that the plans they announced today is that they're going to create a bio hub in San Francisco, which is going to have two major projects to start off with. Firstly, they've got one called Cell Atlas, which wants to map the different types of cells controlling the body's organs. And the second one is an infectious disease initiative to focus on the development of new tests and vaccines against diseases like HIV, Ebola, and Zika. So that's quite similar to kind of the stuff that Bill and Melinda Gates have done with their foundation, like focusing on the vaccination side of things.
Yeah, and they've been doing that for a very, very long time, and to a huge degree. There's been an awful lot of money that they've ploughed into diseases such as polio, tuberculosis, malaria, and AIDS. And I think that earlier this year, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation said it would invest an additional $5 billion into Africa in the next 5 years. And they're getting to a point where potentially polio could no longer be an issue, which is a remarkable achievement, but also kind of a demonstration, in my mind, of what happens when you're clever with how you give your money away, right? It's all very well to say that you have $3 billion and that you're going to try and, air quotes, solve disease by 2100. But then you have to have the intelligence to give that money to the right people and to manage it in the right way so that they can actually make an actionable difference, right?
Yeah, I think this is the thing that the Gates Foundation in particular has been really celebrated for. You know, like The Lancet said that they've given such a massive boost to global health funding. And this is because they give the money to the right organizations who can then go and distribute the vaccines or develop them and things. So, for instance, there's Gavi, which is the Global Vaccine Alliance. And the Gates Foundation has helped them with goals of creating access to vaccines for children all over the world. And I mean, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been going for 15 years. And for Gavi alone, they've donated about $1.5 billion. So that's already half of what Zuckerberg has proposed so far.
Yeah. And you have organizations like, for example, Cancer Research and even the Wellcome Trust. There are an awful lot of non-governmental organizations that are plowing money into trying to come up with solutions to some of humanity's greatest problems. And now you have Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan on the scene. There's going to be, I don't know, not more competition, but there's going to be competing ideas potentially, and more people with quite bold imperial ambitions to solve things based on their vision. What do you think? Is this going to be problematic that you have another very big, dare I say, ego coming into this space?
Who knows? It's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, so Warren Buffett, and sometimes, you know, one of the richest people in the world, he's placed all his money to the Gates Foundation. And this is kind of one way of getting around this potential competition. There is something slightly strange about extremely, extremely rich people taking kind of charge of these issues. And you kind of feel like there should be issues for all of us. But at the same time, I mean, it's kind of incredible, isn't it?
But should they not just give that $3 billion to the UN, to the Wellcome Trust, to cancer research, to whoever it may be?
Well, I think particularly with the Gates Foundation, they work with the UN and they work with the different organizations within that in order to help put it out. And I guess the benefit of a private organization is that there's less bureaucracy. They can probably do things faster. They can probably find and hire people faster in order to do the development. So there is the benefit on that side that they're not constrained by, you know,
that dastardly red tape.
Well, exactly.
That's kind of what they say, right? So when the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative was announced back in 2015, BuzzFeed noticed that not all of the donations would go to charity. The Infectious Disease Initiative that it set up is not a charitable trust, but it's an LLC, so a profit will be made. Zuckerberg has since said that any profit made will be diverted back into the wider goal. But it kind of shows this awkward, like their approach to it might not be the most altruistic thing imaginable, and it's certainly the sort of thing that's going to require a lot of scrutiny. Bill and Melinda Gates have, without wanting to harp on about them, they've shown a really, really great model for how this kind of thing can work, and they've done amazingly with their money. Remains to be seen how successful Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan are with what is obviously a very admirable goal, but difficult, a very difficult one to achieve.
And I think, yeah, that is one of the main points, that transparency around this issue is really important from Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan, because the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have been very transparent, have been very open with what they're spending and their accounts and everything like that. So it'd be really interesting to see if this new initiative from Facebook actually, well, not from Facebook exactly, but from its founder, does actually do this as well and is held accountable. But they're obviously not the only people doing this sort of thing.
Not by a long shot. So Microsoft and Google, we've run stories on them recently. Amelia, you can talk us through what Microsoft did earlier this week with a big announcement of how it's going to, again, air quotes, solve cancer.
Yeah, so the Zuckerbergs don't need to worry about this at the moment. Microsoft has labs in the UK and the US using machine learning to find out how to tackle cancer. So they're thinking that if you look at cancer like a computer problem, if you treat the biological process of cancer like a computational process, you can use the data available and use the similar analysis tools to understand it more and treat it. And they want to be able to put a device into cells which will then know when a cell is going to turn into a cancerous one, detect it straight away and fight it within the body.
Within 10 years.
Yeah, this is what they said, 10 yeah. years, but that will remain to be seen.
So the high-ups at Microsoft might like to read our colleague Joao Medeiros' piece on Berg Pharmaceuticals, which has similar goals to, again, air quotes, solve cancer using artificial intelligence. It's an amazing, amazing effort, and they've come up with a very different way of approaching the problem of cancer, the disease of cancer. And you also have Google, divisions of Alphabet. Google's a division of Alphabet, it gets confusing, but basically a part of Alphabet, which is Google, has teamed up with GlaxoSmithKline in the UK to research, develop and commercialise bioelectronic medicines. So, for example, a tiny implantable device that can monitor nerve signals in the body so it could treat chronic illnesses such as arthritis, diabetes and asthma. That was announced a couple of months ago. So it's an increasingly busy world of technology companies getting very, very invested in solving these huge, huge medical problems.
I think it's really interesting because obviously we can make all these developments in cars and phones or whatever, but there's like this old Chinese proverb that says the first wealth is health. And I think that's really, I really like that. And I think it's very interesting that we can do everything, but if you're sick, you can't enjoy anything. So you may as well like tackling that and using technology in these innovative ways, I think is really exciting.
And they've got a really different approach to this sort of thing out in Silicon Valley. I mean, you know, to solve these problems, not just to manage them, not to treat them, but to completely end them. And the kind of one of the big debates around all this stuff is the idea that's actually incredibly common out there that you should solve death, and that if you could. Oh, James, yep. You're not a deathist, are you?
Oh, yeah, I love death.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it is quite a strange idea in many ways, but it's also testament to the incredible power and ambition of the vision that you might think, yeah, death. That's what we'll do. We'll solve that. We'll end that. I mean, it's quite breathtaking, really.
Ambitious. Makes for good headlines. But let's keep an eye on it. Let's see what Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan do with this initiative, and hopefully they're able to make some real progress and do it in a sensible way. Final thing I want to talk about this week, there's a very clever grid that we've got in the current issue of Wired magazine, which is our design issue. But the grid is concerned with the Ubers of Uber. No, Roland, put down that magazine. No cheating. Right, so I want you all to guess where on our grid we've put on-demand economy apps. So these are things like Uber and Deliveroo and TaskRabbit and things like that. So we've rated them as useful, first world, real world, or pointless. This will be a good introduction to, I think, the on-demand economy and just how much stuff there is in it. Okay, so let's go for Invisible Boyfriend.
I'm going to say that's completely useless.
Hang on.
Wait. I feel like that's a first world problem.
Yeah, hang on. James, you've explained this really badly. It's on a 4x4 matrix.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yes, please. So you rate things, but so you've got to kind of put them on a scale between real world and first world and between useful and pointless.
So this should where should this be? Should it be way out on the far end of real world and useful, or pointless and first world?
Pointless and first world, definitely.
I'm still going with pointless and first world and useless.
We've actually got on our grid as pointless and real world, which is intriguing. Pointless and first world is Handy Mail, handwritten letters. The company now closed, but the idea was that you could email a letter that you wanted handwritten and then they'd then post it for you.
Now, that really is pointless. So to be honest, when we did this, we could have put almost everything into first world and pointless, but we had to kind of make some adjustments.
Well, hold on. So,
to rate things relatively, not everything, of course.
Yeah, as we've got here, got a nation to rule, try Estonia's country operating system management software, which is amazing. There was a story a couple of weeks ago that everything in Estonia to do with taxes and identity is stored digitally. You can vote online, pay your taxes online. Your citizenship is essentially held on a big database.
Country as a service, they call it.
It's amazing. And Estonia, very big country just to the east of it that might be a bit malevolent at the moment. So Estonia is in talks with the United Kingdom to back up Estonia in the UK. So you now have this idea that a country can sort of pick up its trouser legs and just sort of run out and set up somewhere else. That its statehood is only dependent on its ability to exist digitally. Kind of cool. So the on-demand economy isn't quite so useless there. The Collective, solving the housing crisis or building student halls for adults. So this is sort of on-demand housing. First world, real world, pointless, useful?
I say real world, but the problem with things like The Collective is that the prices can be extreme, so a lot of people in the real world wouldn't actually be able to afford it.
I would probably go for a little bit of first world as well, because we've created a housing crisis and this sort of thing is created to try and solve it, I guess.
Laundrap. You see adverts for it all over public transport in London. Basically, you got some dirty pants, you can get someone to pick them up, clean them and deliver them back to you, all with a couple of taps of an app.
Are these picking them up from my bedroom floor or just from the flat?
I'm not sure if that's sort of an added extra.
Oh, what a horrible image.
Yep.
See, because of course something can be extremely first world but very useful, if you see what I mean. So, I mean, it is quite handy. It would be quite handy, that sort of thing. But at the same time, it's so unbelievably first world. It kind of makes you feel impossibly like queasy about how decadent you are using that.
Well, how about the Wardrobe Curator, which tidies overflowing clothing collections?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Is it?
I mean, could be handy.
Yeah, well, I think we definitely... Anyway, so yeah. The reason that I wanted to talk about this is it got me thinking. There seems to be an Uber for anything, and this has sort of been a problem that's been posited for a couple of years now, that everyone who's got the ability to get some money together to make an app is making an on-demand economy app to solve some problem, no matter how small. So TaskRabbit, Uber, Deliveroo are probably very good examples of needs met by clever technology, whether they're controversial or not, and in some cases they are. But if everyone can come up with an idea, why can't you guys? So I want you to pitch me your on-demand economy app, and Lord Sugar-esque, I will decide the victor. Who wants to go first?
Matt, you can go first.
Oh, Matt, you're raring to, I can see.
Okay, we'll save the first. Save the first till last? That doesn't make any sense.
No, the best till first.
The best till first. Okay, I think mine actually might already exist, but I'm going to pitch it anyway. So, you know how often people break their phones? I've got a cracked phone at the moment. I was running to the bus the other day and it fell out of my pocket. Top of it cracked. Can barely use it.
Is this a true story?
Yes, it is. Well, it wasn't last week. It's a few months ago.
Right.
But it is cracked in the top corner. And I want an Uber for fixing phone screens. You'll ring them up or probably email them on your computer because your phone's not working. And they will come to you and fix your phone screen right there, right then, done.
So would you work with different companies? So you'd work with Apple to make sure it's proper genius, and you'd work with HTC to make sure it's the right person fixing it, wouldn't just be a general fixer?
Well, that's a little bit further down the line. You'd probably start off as a general fixer, build up your market, and then get to a stage where you can build these partnerships with your big companies.
So you've got your little repair person turning up with a little tool case, and they've got all the relevant bits of kit, and they can do it right there and then. They don't need to take it away.
Yeah, that's there, it's done. They come to you, they fix it within half an hour, however, like, technical.
It's got to be within half an hour.
Oh, of course, yes.
Otherwise, I get my money back.
And then it's done, and you can use your phone again, and fantastic.
Good. Sensible. Yeah, all right. Who wants to go next?
I have a very unsensible idea to throw into the mix.
Go on, then.
So, you know when you are in a restaurant in London, and you've read about it, and you're really excited to go, but you can't book a table?
Oh.
So you have to stand in a queue outside the restaurant for maybe 2 hours, depending on how popular it is. My idea for an app is that you can get someone to stand in the queue for you, so you can pop off to the pub or just rock up at your time.
Now, this kind of exists already. I think you could use TaskRabbit to do that, because you can pay someone on TaskRabbit, and this is horrible, to stand in a queue to get you the new iPhone.
Okay, TaskRabbit.
So I can imagine you'll be able to get them to stand in a queue for Bao. Or something like that.
Yeah, or Honest Burger, which I still haven't been to because the queues are ridiculous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so, well, I was going to pitch one to myself, but every single idea I had, I Googled and someone else had come up with it already. On-demand board games. That's a thing.
What?
Yeah. Lego subscription services. That's a thing.
Hang on, back up. On-demand board games?
Yeah.
So what? You can just get them to deliver them for a certain amount of time and then you play them?
So I think, there's board game subscription services, there's Lego subscription services, but there's also an on-demand board game service where you pay a fee to unlock a download pack where you then print out your board game, get all the instructions. Lots of them use decks of cards and die and stuff like that. So
does it also come with friends to play them with?
Yeah. Yeah, imaginary friends, Roland. Gives you a Spotify playlist of imaginary friends. Yeah, no. What's your pitch? I'm excited for yours.
Oh, well, I've, this
well,
is,
I was excited for all of them.
This is an idea that if it doesn't exist, it should do. So the key thing about the sharing economy, it's got to use spare capacity. And what is the most criminal waste of capacity in our lives, in our society? Well, it's toilets. Why aren't toilets being used all the time? That's why Pooba is here to solve your needs. Just think, you're out in the street. Actually, the way they do it in startup pitches, they have a little character. It's like, hey, look at Dan. Dan's out in the street. He suddenly wants to go to the loo, but there's nowhere he can go. What does he do? Because he's got the Pooba app, he can register on there and he can see where spare capacity is.
Spare capacity.
Exactly. I mean,
No, I have discussed this before, But you could also, because you could hook up with like different stores, and you know, some like Marks and Spencer always have toilets in their stores, and you could check like how many people are in the queue.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, because when these really work well, it's when they've got some kind of, obviously they've got some kind of intelligent platform that is kind of assigning capacity depending on where people are.
Intelligent poo platform.
Exactly. Mm. Our machine learning powered poo platform.
IPP.
Exactly. That's why we're looking for £10 million for this startup idea.
10 million?
Yeah, to scale up.
You put a lot of thought into this. I'm impressed.
I just go and watch a lot of startup pitches.
Yep. Okay, so you kind of got the cadence of them nailed.
Oh, yeah. Now there'll be the bit where I tell you about my experience.
Go on.
Oh, well, I mean, not my real experience, because no one will be impressed by that. You say like something like, I've got a PhD in machine learning from the University of Cambridge, and my colleagues have over 30 patents from top somethings or other.
And I'm here today to tell you that we're going to solve poop.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yes. Yeah, because then you go into the big vision, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yes.
In 10 years' time.
Yeah. But you've got to make this like a real problem. Like, did you know that that holding in wee kills over 10,000 people a year? That's why I'm here to save those lives.
Pooba.
Pooba. Pooba, you heard it here
Never
first.
Go wanting again.
Yeah. I mean...
Brilliant. Well... I mean, it's a tough one. Amelia, yours already exists.
I'm very sad about that.
It's okay. But it means that your problem is solved.
Yeah, I guess so. But
the
on-demand
economy has your back.
But I can't make any money out of it now.
No sweet VC money for you. Matt Burgess, I'm struggling to even remember. Oh, phone screens, yes. I mean, I kind of think that already exists too, doesn't it?
I think it does. Yeah. I think it's been pitched to me before.
So. So for sheer ingeniousness and the fact that no one would dare to come up with this, and you can kind of imagine someone will eventually, and the name, Pooba.
Pooba.
I can imagine that hitting my inbox.
It's here.
You can have a Pooh Bear as your logo. Like, you know, Winnie the Pooh.
I think the Walt Disney Company might have something to say about that.
Team up.
Yeah, well, great.
Goodbye, everyone.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Yeah. That's the podcast for this week. We'll see you again next week for more of Roland's amazing poop-related startup ideas. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.